CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Katie Comley.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, Premier Gordon Campbell announces new transit funding, and the Catholic Church receives allegations of genocide surrounding BC residential schools. We'll have all this, plus sports and your five-day weather forecast, coming up this half hour right here on News 101. In UBC News, scientists here at the university are working with others to better understand the genetics of the mountain pine beetle. Researchers at Genome Alberta and Genome British Columbia are trying to decode the DNA from the mountain pine beetle, the trees they kill, and a deadly fungus in an attempt to find a way to slow the spread of the beetles. The researchers have just launched a two-year study to look at the genetic interaction of the three groups. Jörg Bollmann, a UBC forestry scientist, says that the research will be helpful because scientists have been slow to predict the infestation of the beetle. Now with a look at other local news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Rita Farkas and Leanne Yu.
New research is indicating more bad news for BC salmon. Dan Moore, a UBC geography professor, says glacial melting because of global warming will have an impact on salmon runs. He says every year many of BC's glaciers are shrinking, which will reduce the amount of cool water entering mountain streams and rivers during the hot summer months. Moore says he thinks many of the province's smaller glaciers will more or less disappear over the next few decades, and this will mean river water temperatures won't be cold enough for salmon survival or spawning during the summer. He points out that glaciers serve as a nice buffering effect because during warm weather melting, increases, which keeps rivers flows high and cool. Moore and his colleagues are analyzing all BC watersheds, which are fed by glaciers, and modeling expected changes in the near future.
The province is searching for a new company to manage some of the most high-profile parks in the Lower Mainland and Fraser Valley. Currently, 10 provincial parks, including Peace Arch Park, Manning Park, Golden Ears, and Cultus Lake, are managed by Gibson Pass Resorts. According to the province, though, Gibson Pass Resorts has failed to pay some of its suppliers, leading to about $80,000 owed. In response, the province has canceled their park permits and are now searching for a new company for the park management contracts. In the meantime, a temporary operator has been found, so there should be no disruptions of service for those wishing to go out and enjoy these parks.
And by the year 2020, taking transit in the Lower Mainland may be a little easier. Today, Premier Gordon Campbell announced a multi-billion dollar plan to upgrade transit in and around Vancouver. This includes $10 billion for expansion on four SkyTrain lines, including the current Canada Line construction, upgrading the Expo Line, and two new rapid transit lines, the UBC Line and the Evergreen Line. Commuters and transit consumers in the Tri-Cities have been waiting a long time for rapid transit. The Evergreen Line, which would link Vancouver to those areas, has been put on hold since the Canada Line became a priority. A lot of suburban commuters say that transportation options haven't been kept up with the rapid population growth. Also included in Campbell's pledge is $1.5 billion to buy 1,500 clean energy buses. Campbell says he wants Vancouver Transit to be on par with the best transit systems in the world, and he counts transit expansion as part of his pledge to make BC more earth-friendly.
BC's Ministry of Transportation is puzzled as to why chunks of ice fell off the Alex Fraser Bridge last Thursday, smashing cars below. A close call came from Ryan Donnelly, who almost didn't make it across the bridge after his car was struck around midnight. A block of ice fell dead center on his windshield, cracking the glass and knocking the wiper blades off his car. At that point, Donnelly was barely able to see through the snow. Two other cases of ice hitting vehicles on the bridge were reported that night. Ministry spokesperson Jeff Knight says this is the second time such cases have been reported. In December 2005, the ministry received over a dozen calls regarding falling ice. Knight adds cameras will be installed on the bridge within the next 2 weeks to monitor the situation to see if prevention is possible.
Protesters confronted Catholic Church officials in Vancouver yesterday over allegations of the existence of mass graves behind many BC residential schools. Kevin Annett, a former United Church minister turned documentary filmmaker, says he has proof of more than half a dozen burial sites in locations such as Port Alberni, Mission, and Alert Bay, which were run by the Catholic Church in the 19th and early 20th centuries. He estimates that 50,000 First Nations children who attended the schools died as the result of disease and abuse of the genocide. Or which he calls genocide, excuse me. Annett, along with 20 members of the group Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared, delivered a letter to Archbishop Raymond Roussin at downtown Vancouver's Holy Rosary Cathedral, asking that the cause of death and whereabouts of the children's remains be disclosed. Father Glenn Dion of the Holy Rosary Cathedral says he doubted the allegation of burial sites, saying the issue was more emotional than factual. It's time for a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
If you're interested in a wicked mix of performances all taking place in one night and locally at one place, then...
It's the fourth annual fundraiser for the North Shore Women's Center.
We're talking about an all-women's mixed program, a rare artistic collaboration of acclaimed local performers that have come together for a common cause.
Happening Saturday, February 2nd, 2008 at the Centennial Theatre located at 2300 Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver.
Tickets available after January 24th, either in person or by phone at the North Shore Women's Centre, the Centennial Theatre box office, or Little Sisters. Reach us by phone at 604-984-6009.
Performances include dancing, theatre, improv, and more. Early bird tickets available.
All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! Leave Brittany alone!
If you don't want to miss your favorite CITR show because it makes fun of the spiel, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now you can get all of the CITR 101.9 FM radio shows off our website and download them straight onto your computer or MP3 players. Just visit www.citr.ca/podcast and dive into a pool of all of the past radio shows, such as...
Because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone!
All to your little heart's desire.
Sweet, sweet, sweet.
CITR.
CITR.
Party! Yeah!
Keep tuning in for more information.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:07. BC may be changing the way it insures fires caused by earthquakes. With a look at that and other stories, here are News 101 reporters Marie Bernard and Tracy Fuller.
Some BC insurance industry lobbyists are pushing for earthquake-caused fires to be removed from regular fire insurance. This while BC's Ministry of Finance is currently revamping the Insurance Act. Right now, if a house catches fire as a result of an earthquake, it's covered under normal fire insurance. But lobbyists are proposing that policyholders should have to purchase a separate earthquake fire insurance package. BC Finance Minister Carol Taylor says no decision has been made yet on the potential changes. Taylor has said she is concerned any changes will be too complicated for consumers to understand. Chuck Byrne from the Insurance Brokers Association of BC says the proposed change is supported by some, but not all, in the industry. He says that it's unknown if the changes will mean customers would have higher insurance premiums. Currently, about 40% of Vancouver residents don't have earthquake insurance.
The leader of BC's marijuana party may soon be extradited to the U.S., where he faces drug-related charges. American drug enforcement officials have been pressing for Mark Emery to be extradited since July 2005. When Emery, along with Greg Williams and Michelle Rainey, were charged for distributing millions of cannabis seeds to customers in the States at an estimated yearly profit of about $3 million. Emery has been fighting extradition to the U.S., arguing that it would mean a lifetime jail sentence because of that country's tough drug laws. Recently, Emery cut a deal with American prosecutors, limiting his jail time to 10 years on the condition that he stop fighting his extradition. Pending federal government approval, the so-called so-called Prince of Pot could be behind bars in the U.S. within 2 months.
And Statistics Canada released a new report today showing that Canadian life expectancy is growing and has now reached 80.4 years. The report stems from 2005 data showing that a baby born in that year would be expected to live until approximately 2085. This compares to 1991 statistics when babies were only expected to live 77.8 years. Stats Canada analyst Bridget Chavez says the numbers have been showing a constant increase. Though the agency hasn't been studying the reasons for longer life expectancy, they do attribute the increase to factors such as health care, better diets, and access to clean water. Also of note in the report is a shrinking divide between men and women. Chavez explains that women are still expected to live longer than men by about 4.7 years, but that these trends are decreasing. The 2005 data also shows that the provincial variations on life expectancy plot British Columbians with the highest expectancy in the country.
Scientists at the University of Guelph are working to develop a biomarker, which will identify the presence of ovarian cancer in its early treatable stages. Known as the silent killer, ovarian cancer affects about 1 in 70 Canadian women. It's a particularly frustrating disease, explained Jim Petrick, a biomedical science professor at the University of Guelph, because the cancer usually progresses to a terminal stage without showing any notable symptoms. If Dr. Petrick and his colleagues could catch ovarian cancer in its early stages, it would be a very treatable disease. Right now, the team is focusing on a particular protein found in mice and humans that may act as an indicator for the disease. Although their research is still in its preliminary stages, researchers at the University of Pittsburgh report that biomarkers, like the protein that Dr. Petrick and his staff are researching, are usually about 96% accurate in detecting the illness. About 2,300 Canadian women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer each year, and 1,600 women will die from the disease.
Finance Minister Jim Flaherty says there's no substance to worries that Canada will run a deficit if the economy slows. Flaherty was responding to claims by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives that the federal treasury could be in the red if economic growth slows. Flaherty told reporters that the government had long anticipated an economic slowdown and sought to mitigate the trend with October's business tax cuts. The minister said he intends to continue to spend within the rate of growth of the economy in order to maintain a budget surplus. The CCPA has criticized Flaherty's approach, saying that cutting government spending during a downturn would only make a recession worse. The left-leaning policy group also found fault with last fall's business tax cuts, saying they were a risky move, which left the federal government with less of a cushion if the economy turns sour.
And in international news, it's been over a decade since the world first met Dolly the sheep, the world's first cloned animal. But as Molly Stentz of FSRN tells us, we may be seeing more cloned animal products at your local grocery store sooner than you think.
It's been over a decade since the birth of the first cloned mammal, Dolly the sheep, was announced to the world, and it's been nearly 5 years since she was put down due to progressive lung disease and arthritis. As early as this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration could lift its moratorium on the use of cloned animals in food. Last Friday, the European Union's equivalent body, the Food Safety Agency, announced that preliminary studies showed no unique health risks from cloned animal byproducts. The FDA published their draft study on cloning in December of 2006, which indicated that the agency was close to declaring cloned animal products safe for consumption. Since that time, the agency has been reviewing scientific studies as well as the reported 100,000 public comments it received in order to determine whether these animals are truly fit for human consumption. Molly Stentz from WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, has the story.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is reportedly days away from approving cloned animals into our food supply amidst public unease. However, the agency will not comment as to whether they have reached a decision. They give no official timeline and will only say they're updating their assessment. Biogen, a biotech company based in Austin, Texas, is one of the largest producers of cloned animals in the U.S., having created many of the nearly 600 in existence. Leah Wilkinson, policy director for Biogen, says the cloning technology they've developed is safe, thoroughly tested, and ready for market. She downplays the impact cloned animals could have on the food chain, saying clones are so costly farmers won't use them for milk or meat directly. A cloned cow, for example, costs between $15,000 and $20,000, nearly 10 times the cost of an average dairy cow.
The cloning technology can be applicable to both dairy and beef production, as well into pork production. The value in a cloned animal is in its genetic material, and so these animals are going to be used for breeding purposes. They're not going to be made to go into feedlots to become the beef in your retail store. The products that will end up going into the food supply will be the offspring of a cloned animal.
According to Wilkinson, farmers and ranchers would want to save the genetics of their best producing or best tasting cow or pig in order to improve the quality of their herd. She says the initial FDA review includes hundreds of independent scientific studies that found cloned animals as healthy as non-clones. Scott and Julie Trotman raise beef and dairy cattle in southern Wisconsin. Scott Trotman says they don't need or want this technology. They're small farmers by today's standards, raising around 50 cows each year, which they sell directly from their farm. Their farm is certified organic, and they have no desire to clone any of their animals nor buy any clones. Farmers like the Troutmans see the philosophical risks inherent in this technology as unneeded and unnecessary.
Is this something that's so necessary right now that it's worth gambling on now and think we're not going to have unintended consequences? We don't know enough. We know all about the advantages right now. We don't know nearly enough about the possible problems down the road.
Dan Neeson, a conventional dairy farmer in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, also isn't too sure about this technology. Neeson, like most of the U.S. public, wasn't aware of the FDA's current study and already heard that cloned animals were already on the market. Neeson explains his doubts from the milking parlor on his farm.
Go ahead and do it, but I would say don't put the meat and the milk in the food chain just because of a public perception. And I'm not a scientist. I don't know if it's safe or not safe. We were told this by Monsanto when they came out with RBGH. We thought that there wouldn't be much public problem with BGH, but now after about 5 or 6 years, we're starting to see a lot of people have a difficulty with BGH.
BGH, or bovine growth hormone, was a product sold by Monsanto to dairy farmers to increase their herd's milk production, one which many consumers chose to boycott over fear of contaminated milk. The dairy industry has already taken a stand on the issue of cloning. The country's largest commercial milk producer, Dean Foods, has already stated they won't sell any milk from cloned animals. Many large farmer cooperatives, such as the Dairy Farmers of America and Organic Valley, don't support cloning. The Food Marketing Institute, the supermarket lobby, has also expressed resistance. But the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the Beef Lobby, and the American Meat Institute, along with the American Farm Bureau, support cloning. Casey Langdon from Wisconsin Farm Bureau explains.
The American Farm Bureau's policy has always been to support the continued development of animal cloning and to support the determination not to regulate them differently. We want farmers and ranchers to have access to modern technology that is safe and that enhances the quality of ag products.
Critics say there are a host of problems with cloning and with the FDA's decision to greenlight their use in food products. They list animal welfare, lack of adequate scientific data, and consumer opposition among their chief concerns. The Center for Food Safety is one of the leading critics of the use of cloning in our food system.
We found that, you know, this is not a good scientific review. The FDA had virtually no peer-reviewed studies in their review. They had only 3 peer-reviewed studies on milk from cloned cows. Their own peer-reviewed team included a woman that has patents on goat cloning and a man that has patents on pig cloning. And the FDA didn't even bother to disclose this. We had to review who these people were and say, wait a second, that's not what an independent review looks like. The FDA has had conflicts of interest in its drug reviews, and now it has conflicts of interest in its animal cloning reviews.
Both advocates and critics alike seem to agree on a few things, that the FDA will likely approve the technology soon and that there will be public concern. Congress has weighed in with the recently adopted omnibus spending bill, which calls for further studies from the National Academy of Sciences and USDA. If similar provisions in the Senate Farm Bill pass, these studies would become a mandate to the agency. I'm Molly Stenz for WORT in Madison, Wisconsin.
And thanks to FSRN for making that piece available to us for rebroadcast. It's time for another break, but there's still much more to come on News 101. When we come back, Jeff Sargent will tell us what's happening in UBC Athletics. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR podcast update. Number 5.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. As it comes more and more into our personal lives, How are we going to cope with the techno-peasants? I mean, because this is, this world, which was a fantasy for me 10 years ago, every 6 months becomes more a part of my own real life. You know, in the place where I do most of my writing, I now am just hooked into the world electronically. That's right, or yeah. Would be if I could figure out how to make the bleep bleep modem work. But I'm technologically over my head already. The limit on me is not what you can do, it's what I can do.
I'm not sure you want to use your bleep bleep modem, or any modem for that matter, with receiving podcasts. But, just check out our website and I'm sure you'll figure it out.
For more information, visit citr.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening and please be kind to robots.
Let me get this straight.
Experimental days of broadcasting as such are over.
Thursday, January 17th, CITR celebrates art's birthday with another 24 hours of radio art.
To confuse.
The Art of Sounds. Thursday, January 17th, midnight to midnight. 24 hours of radio art. Happy birthday, Art. From CITR 101.9, Vancouver. For CITR.ca.
Well, of course, that's the sound you don't hear very often. But it is the real thing.
You must keep reminding yourself. It's just a
sound collage.
It's just a
sound collage.
It's just a
sound collage.
It's just a sound collage.
Only a madman could understand it all.
I can understand that.
February 20th, tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
They say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you know what, see, like when you panhandle, people like you to come up with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:22 and time for a look back at the past weekend in UBC athletics. Here's Jeff Sargent with Thunderbird Eye on Sports.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the Monday edition of the Thunderbird Eye. We'll start with the men's basketball team. They had a frustrating split over the weekend as Friday they played 8th-ranked Brandon in one of the marquee matchups of the Canadian basketball season. UBC played without star Chris Dick, but was able to build up a 14-point lead late in the first half. Brandon came back with a 10-0 run before the break, though, and they slowly wore down UBC in the third before outscoring them 23-12 in the final period. The final score was 92-78 for the Bobcats. It's the second big fourth-quarter collapse UBC has had this year against a ranked team. Forward Brent Malish blamed it on a lack of communication on offense. He led the Birds with 18 points and 10 rebounds. The Thunderbirds rebounded the next day, though, with a 78-65 win over Regina. UBC opened with a 16-0 run and was able to hold the Cougars the rest of the way. Blaine LaBranche led the Birds with 17 points.
We pulled out the victory, which is the main thing. A lot of guys coming off the bench didn't really bring enough energy. But, we picked it up in the second half and we pulled out the victory, so that's all that matters.
With the split, UBC now sits at 12-3. They play their fourth game in 7 days tomorrow night against Simon Fraser. That's a home game starting at 7 p.m., and we'll have it for you live on CITR and on the web at citr.ca. The last time these two teams played, they went right to the buzzer with UBC winning by 2 in overtime. The UBC women had a much easier time with their Prairie visitors, despite a slow start Friday night. They trailed for much of the first quarter against the winless Brandon, but veterans Erica McGinnis and Kate Haggerty took charge, sparking a 34-4 run over the second and third quarters. The blowout was on after that. UBC ended up with the 99-46 win. McGinnis scored 23, while Haggerty had 15 points and 7 steals. Rookie Alex Viewig added another 16 points. On Saturday, UBC completed the sweep, beating Regina 66-43. And it was McGinnis and Haggerty leading the way once again. UBC came out hot early, taking a 22-9 lead into the first quarter break. They held a double-digit lead before the Cougars closed to 8 in the final period. But that's when Haggerty took over, scoring UBC's next 11 points to put the game away. Here's Haggerty after the game.
We knew they'd come out hard. They're big, really good offensive rebounding team and defensive rebounding team. So we knew we needed to take care of the boards. And just that they'd come out hard. Deb gave us a scouting report and know their tendencies and stuff like that, and they just try to take that away from them.
The women are now at 14-2 as they return to action this weekend at Victoria. Well, it's been anything but a happy new year for the UBC men's hockey team. After dropping home games to Calgary on January 4th and 5th, the Birds were swept this past weekend on the road in Regina. The Cougars followed up on a 1-0 victory Friday with a dominant 7-1 defeat of UBC Saturday. The Thunderbirds have now dropped to 9-11 on the season, tied with Regina for 5th place in the Canada West with 18 points. Scott Lynch spoiled Brant Hilton's bid for a second consecutive shutout early in the third period Saturday, scoring UBC's only goal in the two-game set. The Thunderbirds will attempt to get back on track this coming weekend as they host the Lethbridge Pronghorns. We'll have the Friday game for you on our website, citr.ca, with the Saturday tilt featured right here on 101.9 FM. Puck drop both nights is at 7:30 p.m. After squeaking out a 4-3 victory over Lethbridge on Friday, the UBC women's hockey team suffered another setback in their push for the playoffs as the Pronghorns shut out the T-Birds 2-0 Saturday night at the Winter Sports Center. In a game dominated by UBC, it was the outstanding play of Lethbridge goalie Kaylee McMaster and the third period performance of Charlotte Hayner that proved to be the difference. With the win, UBC would have pulled even with the Saskatchewan Huskies for the fourth and final playoff spot in the Canada West, but the loss drops UBC's record to 6-11-1, leaving them on the outside looking in with just 6 games remaining in the season. And it only gets tougher from here on in. The Birds are in Regina this weekend to take on a Cougars squad that beat UBC in 2 meetings here back in November. They'll then head to Saskatoon for games against the Huskies on January 25th and 26th. Well, the women's volleyball team is now working on an 8-game winning streak. That's after sweeping their weekend series with the Bobcats in Brandon. Friday night, the Lady Birds found themselves down 2-0, but a huge rally gave UBC the win with 28-26, 25-16, and 15-9 victories. Jamie Broder led the way with 20 kills, and she says the comeback win was gratifying.
It was a really tough fought match and showed a lot of character that we could pull it out after being down 2 sets in the beginning. To come out and win the third was really, really great for us.
Saturday's rematch wasn't quite as taxing, as UBC took care of the Bobcats in 4 sets, this time with Jen Hinze leading all players with 18 kills. The Birds once again lost the first set, but rallied quickly to improve their record to 11-1, tied for first place in the Canada West with 2 games in hand on the Calgary Dinos. Next up for the Thunderbirds is a 2-game home series against the Thompson Rivers Wolfpack Friday and Saturday. Both games have a 6 p.m. start, with Saturday's being webcast live at citr.ca. And the men's volleyball team also had a successful weekend, sweeping their series against the Cougars in Regina. Following Friday's straight sets victory, veteran Thunderbird Matt Lubourdais led the Birds to a 4-set win Saturday with a game-high 16 kills, while Steve Gotch added 15 kills and 4 blocks. UBC now sits atop the Canada West standings with a 10-2 record. They'll now return home to host Thompson Rivers Friday and Saturday. Both of those games have an 8 p.m. start, and Saturdays will be webcast at citr.ca and gothunderbirds.ca. And finally, in other Thunderbirds news, NCAA Division II delegates have approved a pilot program today, allowing Canadian schools to apply for membership as soon as June 1st. This could lead to Canadians eventually competing in some Division I sports. Now, details have yet to be worked out, but the concept is designed to allow Canadian schools to enter into the pilot program and explore membership. Schools that meet the June 1st application deadline could start the process of joining Division II as early as the 2008-09 academic year. The pilot program allows the NCAA to study any logistical challenges involved with competing outside the U.S. UBC and Simon Fraser are among six Canadian schools that have discussed NCAA membership. They're among the Canadian schools that would like to award full athletic scholarships, but cannot as part of the CIS. That's your Thunderbird Eye on Sports for this Monday. I'm Jeff Sargent.
And we wrap up tonight with our meteorologist Selena Ferris and your five-day weather forecast. Selena?
We are going to be getting a break from all the rain for the next few days. A high-pressure system off the coast will be settling over the region for the week. Tonight, there is a wind warning in effect, which will drive the last remaining clouds out of the area, so expect a clear and sunny day tomorrow with a high of 4 degrees. Wednesday, the clouds will roll back in, but conditions should remain dry, a high of 3 degrees, and a low down to negative 2 overnight. The rest of the week, we'll see a dry mix of sun and cloud with temperatures just above freezing. That's your five-day weather brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Thanks, Selena. And that's our program for Monday, January 14th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, this is Katie Conley thanking you for listening. Stay tuned for Wings, coming up next on 101.9 FM CITR.